Chapter 80. The old escape route from the main quarry sloped downward into the bowels of the hill. The walls were 7 feet high and showed the scars from the miners' picks. The air was moist with the faint but ominous smell of a mausoleum. After about 20 yards, the passageway curved and all light was lost from the outside. The dive lights were switched on, and Pitt, followed by Riley and three men, continued on, their footsteps echoing into the eternal darkness ahead. They passed an empty ore car, its small iron wheels joined in rusting bond to narrow rails. Several picks and shovels stood neatly stacked in a chiseled niche as though waiting for calloused hands to grasp their handles again. Nearby were other artifacts. A broken miner's lamp, a sledgehammer, and the faded, stuck-together pages of a Montgomery Ward catalog. The pages were frozen open on advertisements displaying upright player pianos. A jumble of fallen rocks blocked their way for 20 minutes until they cleared a path. Everyone kept a suspicious eye trained on the rotting timbers that sagged under the weight of the crumbling roof. No word was spoken while they worked. The uncommunicated fear of being crushed by a cave-in chilled their minds. Finally, they wormed their way past the barrier and found the tunnel floor covered by several inches of water. When their knees became submerged, Pitt stopped and held up a hand. "The water level will be over our heads before long," he said. "I think the safety team better set up operations here." Riley nodded. "I agree." The three divers, who were to remain behind in case of an emergency, began stacking the reserve air tanks and securing the end of an orange fluorescent cord that was wound around a large reel. As they arranged the gear, the dive lights danced spasmodically on the passage walls, and their voices seemed alien and magnified. When Pitt and Riley had removed their hiking boots and replaced them with swim fins, they grabbed hold of the reel and continued on, unwinding the safety line as they went. The water soon came to their waists. They halted to adjust their face masks and clamp their teeth on the mouthpieces of the air regulators. Then they dropped into the liquid void. Below the surface, it was cold and gloomy. Visibility was amazingly sharp, and Pitt felt a shiver of almost superstitious awe when he spied a tiny salamander whose eyes had degenerated to the point of total blindness. He marveled that any kind of life form could exist in such entombed isolation. The quarry's escape shaft seemed to stretch downward like a great sloping, bottomless pit. There was something malignant about it, as though some cursed and unmentionable force lurked in the shadowy depths beyond the beams of the dive lights. After 10 minutes, by Pitt's dive watch, they stopped and took stock. Their depth gauges registered 105 feet. From beneath his face mask, Pitt's eyes studied Riley. The dive master made a brief check of his air pressure gauge and then nodded an okay to keep going. The shaft began to widen into a cavern, and the sides turned a dirty gold color. They had finally passed into a gallery of the limestone quarry. The floor leveled out, and Pitt noted that the depth had slowly risen to 60 feet. He aimed his light upward. The beam reflected on what looked like a blanket of quicksilver. He ascended like a ghost in flight and suddenly broke into air. He had surfaced in an air pocket below the ceiling of a large domed chamber. A crowd of stalactites fell around him like icicles, their conical tips ending inches above the water. Too late, Pitt ducked under to warn Riley. Unable to see because of the surface reflection, Riley rammed his face mask into the tip of a stalactite, shattering the glass. The bridge of his nose was gashed and his eyelids were sliced. He would not know until later that the lens of his left eye was gone. Pitt threaded his way through the cone-shaped trunks and gripped Riley under the arms. "What happened?" Riley mumbled. "Why are the lights out?" "You met the wrong end of a stalactite," said Pitt. "Your dive light is broken." "I lost mine." Riley did not buy the lie. He removed a glove and felt his face. "I'm blind," he said matter-of-factly. "Nothing of the sort." Pitt eased off Riley's mask and gently picked away the larger glass fragments. The dive master's skin was so numb from the icy water that he felt no pain. "What rotten luck. Why me?" "Stop complaining. A couple of stitches and your ugly mug will be as good as new." "Sorry to screw things up. I guess this is as far as we go." "You go." "You're not heading back?" No, I'm pushing on. How's your air? Ample. You can't kid an old pro, buddy. There's barely enough left to reach the backup team. You keep going and you forfeit your round-trip ticket to the surface. Pitt tied the safety line around a stalactite. Then he clamped Riley's hand on it. Just follow the yellow brick road and mind your head. A comedian you ain't. What do I tell the Admiral? He'll castrate me when he learns I left you here. Tell him, Pitt said with a tight grin, I had to catch a train. Corporal Richard Willapaw felt right at home stalking the damp woods of New York. A direct descendant of the Chinook Indians of the Pacific Northwest, he had spent much of his youth tracking game in the rainforests of Washington State, honing the skills that enabled him to approach within 20 feet of a wild deer before the animal sensed his presence and darted away. His experience came in handy as he read the signs of recent human passage. The footprint had been made by a short man, he judged, wearing a size 7 combat boot similar to his own. Moisture from the mist had not yet redampened the impressions, an indication to Willapaw's trained eye that they were no more than half an hour old. The tracks came from the direction of a thicket and stopped at a tree. Then they returned. Willapaw noted with amusement the thin wisp of vapor that rose from the tree trunk. Someone had walked from the thicket, relieved himself, and walked back again. He looked around at his flanks, but none of his squad was visible. His sergeant had sent him out to scout ahead, and the rest had not caught up yet. Willapaw stealthily climbed into the crotch of a tree and peered into the thicket. From his vantage point in height, he could see the outline of a head and shoulders hunched over a fallen log. All right, he shouted. I know you're in there. Come out with your hands up. Willapaw's answer was a hail of bullets that flayed the bark off the tree below him. Christ almighty, he muttered in astonishment. No one had told him he might be shot at. He aimed his weapon, pulled the trigger, and sprayed the thicket. The firing on the hill intensified and echoed through the valley. Lieutenant Sanchez snatched up a field radio. Sergeant Ryan, do you read? Ryan answered almost immediately. Ryan here, go ahead, sir. What in hell is going on up there? We stumbled on a hornet's nest, Ryan replied jerkily. It's like the Battle of the Bulge. I've already taken 3 casualties. Sanchez was stunned by the appalling news. Who's firing on you? They ain't no farmers with pitchforks. We're up against an elite outfit. Explain. We're being hit with assault rifles by guys who damn well know how to use them. We're in for it now, Shaw shouted, ducking his head as a continuous burst of fire raked the leaves above. They're coming at us from the rear. No amateurs, those Yanks, Macklin yelled back. They're biding their time and whittling us down. The longer they wait, the better. Shaw crawled over to the pit where Caldwyler and 3 others were still frantically digging, oblivious to the battle going on around them. Any chance of breaking through? You'll be the first to know when we do, the Welshman grunted. The sweat was pouring down his face as he hauled up a bucket containing a large boulder. We're near 70 feet down. I can't tell you any more than that. Shaw ducked suddenly as a bullet ricocheted off the rock in Caldwyler's hands and took away the left heel of his boot. You better lay low till I call you, Caldwyler said calmly, as though remarking about the weather. Shaw got the message. He dropped down into the shelter of a shallow depression beside Burton Angus, who looked to be enjoying himself returning the fire that blasted out of the surrounding woods. Hit anything? Asked Shaw. Sneaky bastards never show themselves, said Burton Angus. They learned their lessons in Vietnam. He rose to his knees and fired a long, leisurely burst into a dense undergrowth. His answer was a rain of bullets that hammered into the ground around him. He abruptly jerked upright and fell back without a sound. Shaw crouched over him. Blood was beginning to seep from 3 evenly spaced holes across his chest. He looked up at Shaw, the brown eyes beginning to dull, the face already turning pale.
Bloomin' queer, he rasped. Getting shot on American soil? Who would have believed it?
The eyes went unseeing and he was gone. Sergeant Bentley slipped through the brush and looked down, his expression granite. Too many good men are dying today, he said slowly. Then his face hardened and he cautiously peered over the top of the embankment. The fire that killed Burton Angus, he judged, came from an elevation. He spotted a perceptible movement high in the leaves. He set his rifle on semi-automatic fire, took careful aim, and ripped off 6 shots. He watched with grim satisfaction as a body slipped slowly out of a tree and crumpled to the moist ground. Corporal Richard Willapaw would never again stalk the deer of his native rainforest.